Hello, folks, and welcome to, I guess it's our last e-learning session of 2016. Rather remarkable, but I know none of us are any older. That I can guarantee. Our topic today is essential tasks closing out 2016 and then starting 2017 off right. We remind those of you who are attending our live webinar that we encourage you to ask questions via the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen, as we are unable to use the raise hand function. We will make our best efforts to answer all your questions. However, if we are unable to answer your questions, of course, and each of our team member will be in contact shortly to set up a time for you to speak with an advisor. We remind everybody that all of our previous topics can be heard directly by visiting our online resource center at e2rsolutions.com. And we'd also note from the legalese perspective that this webinar today is of general application, and if you require specific advice in connection with your specific facts and circumstances, please contact us directly. Our next e-learning with E2R will take place on January 26, 2017. Without further ado, let's get into this. And today with me is Aaron. And between the two of us, hopefully, we'll cover two full years, which is an ambitious project for us, but we anticipate being successful. So by way of agenda, December 2016, of course, given the time of year, we're going to talk about holiday parties, statutory holidays, all fun stuff, vacation audit, and performance reviews. Then as we move in, we take care of our hangovers and get into January 2017. We'll be looking at statutory holidays, employee information, minimum wage, T4s, statutory deductions, payroll generally, posting and training, vacation, policies and employee handbooks, and employment agreements. So as you can see, we have lots to cover, and we don't plan on breathing on this end, so we can get through it all. So let's start with our December 2016 holiday parties. So many of you will indeed be planning the holiday office party. And of course, that's a festive time, an opportunity for colleagues to get together in a non-work environment to enjoy each other's company and talk about, hopefully, the successful year that business has had. But you have to bear in mind that as a host for these kinds of events, as an employer, you need to be mindful of the issues that can arise from conducting these kinds of functions. In particular, and it won't come as a surprise to any of you, I'm sure, that if an employer allows employees or permits employees to consume alcohol on the premises, right, or in connection with any corporate holiday event, you expose yourself to potential liability, and quite frankly, that liability can be significant. Some of the areas where you can potentially see vulnerability as an employer sponsoring an alcohol-related function include what we've listed there. Claims of discrimination, social host liability. It sounds so nice when you refer to social host, but of course the last word is liability. That's not necessarily such a beautiful sounding word. Sexual harassment, of course, is more ripe on those occasions where alcohol is served. And workers' compensation issues as well, because the question is, are we involved in a work-related activity for which benefits could be payable in the appropriate circumstances?
Wow, we're the Debbie Downers of holiday parties.
Yeah, we're not fun at all.
Yeah, that doesn't make it sound like a fun time, but we're not trying to prevent you from having a fun time. We're just trying to make sure that we put all the checks and balances in place to reduce that liability. So what first a lot of people don't think about as it relates to holiday parties is potential discrimination. And this can come up very inadvertently when you're planning these holiday parties, particularly when you phrase things such as a Christmas party, a Hanukkah party, a Kwanzaa party, any other specific religious events. When you use those names and titles, you could potentially be excluding other employees of other religions, and they may in fact take offense to it. So it sounds like we're telling you we're living in a PC world, and we are. So when you are in fact creating these parties, you need to be very wary of overtly planning and advertising them as a specific holiday party such as Christmas, because that does appear like you're adhering to one specific religious tradition. And particularly, you do not want to give that impression if you're going to say that your holiday party is mandatory, because then it seems like you are in fact trying to impose your potential religious beliefs on your employee. Another way that discrimination can come up, and it again relates to this whole idea of serving and providing alcohol, is if you have somebody who does get visibly intoxicated at the company holiday party, and then you decide to terminate them the very next day without investigating further, you do so taking on the risk that that person in fact suffers from alcohol addiction, and therefore you have in fact discriminated against them on the basis of a disability. So how do we possibly avoid these claims? Well, first and foremost, and this generally applies across the board whether or not we're talking about holiday parties or not, never ever terminate on the spot. Always in those sorts of situations, especially in the example of the employee who gets intoxicated, best practice would be to conduct an investigation and only decide the appropriate course of action, whether or not it's disciplinary or in fact termination. Once you've undertaken that investigation, you've gathered all information, and you can make a safe decision moving forward.
It's funny, Erin, you're talking about termination, but we've also seen where an employee who's intoxicated will elect, because he or she is aired some of their concerns about working at this particular establishment, and they resign. And of course, the employer jumps on that and says, they're going to take that opportunity to accept that resignation. But of course, if the employee is inebriated, then in all likelihood, that communication of a resignation is not going to be a resignation in law. So, you know, alcohol affects a lot of decision making, so you have to be careful in those circumstances what you do and what you rely on.
In addition to obviously decisions about termination, just in the general planning stage, you really want to make sure here that we're considering everyone's diverse backgrounds, everyone's cultural beliefs, and so we're going to be phrasing these parties not as the Christmas party, not as the Hanukkah party, whatever the case might be, and just phrase it as a general holiday party, year-end party, something very non-religious in title. And obviously then that means when we're planning any decorations, we want to ensure that, again, we're not containing references to any particular religion. That means no nativity scenes, no Star of David's hanging around. We need to take all of that into consideration. So I would say Frosty the Snowman, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and maybe Santa Claus might be okay, but I mean, it depends upon your thoughts on Saint Nick.
Well, you know, it's funny, and you know, we smile as we, you know, as Erin discusses this, and for, you know, some degree for obvious reasons. But, you know, the reality is these are legitimate legal issues, and there are certainly cases where you have employees, a little bit sort of on a tangent here, but very related, you have employees that are asked by retailers, for example, to adorn the Christmas tree in the store. And the employee refuses to do it on the basis of a religious objection to it. And the employer insists, hey, I'm not asking you to adopt the religion. I'm just asking you to put tinsel on the tree. And the employee says no, and then the employer terminates. That has attracted liability from the employer perspective. So this stuff is real, right? And so as much as we perhaps and have some views on whether it's appropriate or not, that you have to park on the side, and recognize that we are dealing with legitimate legal issues.
And just one final note, and this will come up further in our discussions on these other issues, but never make participation in an attendance at these holiday events mandatory. That's just from a general liability standpoint, it's going to substantially increase the possibility of liability being attached to the company party if we make it mandatory. And this would not only apply to possible discrimination claims, but as Stu's going to talk about later on, workers' compensation as well.
So let's talk about social host liability. Once again, somewhat inviting for the first two words, not inviting for the third. So as part of the theme of today's discussion today are the liabilities that can arise from sponsoring a holiday party. And it can arise from the actions of employees while attending the company function and even after they have departed. And typically what you're looking at are two different types of employer liability in these circumstances. It's referred to in one case as provider liability. So it's liability for those who actually provide, serve, or make alcohol available to who? To somebody they know or ought to know is already intoxicated and, of course, at great risk to themselves and indeed other third parties by continuing to consume alcohol. Now, having said that, as you see in our note, no one in Canada has ever been held liable for serving or providing alcohol in a reasonable manner. So if you're conducting yourself reasonably as the provider of alcohol, then in all likelihood, there is a very, very low risk of liability. Now, can an employer be a provider, can in effect have liability under this provider liability heading? Sure. If you're supplying alcohol, right, pursuant to a liquor license or under any special occasion permit that you've obtained as the employer, well, you may very well fall under the rubric of provider liability. Right? And therefore, if you overserve someone, then clearly you may be at risk. Now, if you hold it at a licensed restaurant, then a restaurant is going to be considered the provider of the alcohol, right? And that's, of course, even assuming, of course, you're not going to run out and you're going to pay the bill, the restaurant is going to assume that liability under provider liability. The other area of concern is what's referred to as occupier liability. So this relates to the property. Whose property is it? Is it our property? Did we rent out the property? It's leased premises? The occupier, the people who are effectively operating within that premises. Right? So if you are considered an occupier or co-occupier, right, when renting premises, then you may indeed have liability qua occupier for once again not controlling appropriately the alcohol consumption of one of your attendees, and that attendee subsequently is involved in some circumstance that gives rise to damage, typically to a third party, and Aaron's going to talk about how that can happen in a specific case. Now, once again, if we're talking about a restaurant, well, then you're not going to have liability under occupier's liability if you're at a restaurant.
What's the worst case scenario here? When we're talking about liability, are we actually talking a significant risk here? Well, I mean, it really depends upon if the worst case scenario, somebody gets intoxicated at the company Christmas party, goes out and subsequently gets hurt. And on the next couple of slides, we're just going to review a case in which it is, in fact, the worst case scenario, and it does, in fact, relate to a company held Christmas party, or rather, I should say holiday party. Revise that. So, at this particular party, a receptionist was expected to attend, carry out her job duties, and clean up following the event. So she was basically an employee at this event. But during this event, she was permitted to drink and became visibly intoxicated. A manager did notice this and threatened that they would call her husband if she continued to carry on. but they took no further steps other than making that threat and did not prevent her from drinking for the next 2.5 hours or prevent her from driving. Nobody took those keys away from her. Nobody called a taxi. Nobody sent her home with another employee who could drive her. Nobody called her husband. Unfortunately, she decided to drive to a bar after work where she had an additional 2 drinks, and then when driving home, got into a serious car accident and suffered permanent physical and cognitive injury. The employer in this situation was held 30% negligent for her actions. And the court made a couple of comments specifically as it related to the employer's specific liability, particularly that they had a general duty to safeguard the employee that extended beyond the confines of the office. So once she left the office, the company did have a duty to ensure she had that safe ride home. Then it specifically stated from the court that they should have either demanded her keys and should she go home by a cab at the company's expense, called her husband, called the police, just taken steps to protect her. You know, it's that basic situation where even if the person saying, I feel fine to drive home, don't let them drive home. And then obviously the court in this particular situation was also critical of the employer for setting up an unsupervised self-serve bar that made it impossible to monitor employees or guests' alcohol consumption. So even if they noticed her continuing to get drunk, nobody was really particularly paying attention to how many more drinks she consumed after they noticed that, and there was no way to keep track of it because nobody was manning the bar.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I remember when this case first came out, an interesting discussion ensued, and rightly so, which is, you know, all of this in theory, well, let's assume, first of all, if you don't permit employees to overindulge and you have protocols in place to ensure that doesn't happen, then there really isn't a whole lot to talk about beyond that. But if you permit a circumstance such as this to occur, well, then essentially what the court seemed to be saying, and nobody even to this day is really clear on really what is the court saying to the employer in this circumstance once the inebriated employee elects to get in her vehicle and drive on, is that, well, what are we supposed to do? Tackle the employee when the employee says, I don't want to return the keys. I'm not giving them to you. Here, they're in my pocket. If you touch that employee, it's an assault. So as an employer, you're sitting there going, well, what am I supposed to do, right? Sure, you can try to call anybody and everybody that may provide assistance, but you're really left in a very difficult circumstance if that employee within seconds is walking down and outside the exit door, and you know she's about to get in the car. So, you know, and to this day, once again, a difficult scenario. What do you do? Well, of course, what you do is ensure that it doesn't happen. That circumstances is highly unlikely to happen. So let's talk then about some of the options that you have as an employer as it relates to these kinds of functions. Of course, and talk about Aaron identifying at the outset that we're sort of buzzkills. Well, I guess the first point underscores that tenfold. Well, why don't you have an alcohol-free event? Thank God I can't see any of you people because you're probably frowning in a significant way. But obviously, in light of a changing world, it is what it is. An alcohol-free event certainly avoids the kinds of liability we're talking about, right? So you need to consider it. Having said that, if you decide to serve alcohol, clearly, as you saw in the case that Aaron was describing, you don't have an open bar, right? You just clearly do not have that. And make sure non-alcoholic beverages, of course, are available to all the employees and any attendees, for that matter. And you need to restrict and monitor the alcohol consumption. Now, whether that's drink tickets, probably a good idea to hire a third party to serve the drinks, because remember then, that third party is likely going to assume most of the liability there, if not all the liability, because that's their role. And they have their smart servers, right, who have taken the courses, etc. In addition, you always want to remind employees for any social event that's serving alcohol in particular, that, hey, this, albeit perhaps a festive atmosphere, nevertheless, this is a business event. So if it's a business event, all company policies regarding employee behavior continue to apply. Certainly the code of conduct and all other applicable policies. And so it's important to remind everybody, it's not a license to conduct yourself in a manner that's inconsistent with those policies. They have to, right, consume alcohol in a responsible manner and ensure that they, of course, have transportation arrangements are made prior to the event. And from the employer's perspective, you know, you really need to think about, yes, we recognize there are costs associated with that, but taxi chits, et cetera, that could be made available to employees to ensure a safe transportation home.
So as Stu kind of hinted at when he was initially going over the agenda, is that when alcohol is involved, this is when we unfortunately see an increase as it relates to promiscuous behavior. And so it's always a good idea this time of year just to review what sexual harassment is and what to potentially do to reduce these sorts of claims at these holiday parties. And first and foremost, I think it's important to remember here that, as Stuart had just mentioned, at these company parties, all company policies still apply. And this obviously includes the respect in the workplace policy, which clearly outlines any information as it relates to sexual harassment. And as we will be mentioning later on, obviously it might be good to review this policy prior to hosting these parties. But just from a legal perspective, the definition of sexual harassment is that it occurs in the course of a vexatious comment or conduct that is known or ought to be known to be unwelcome, that is obviously sexual in nature. In some cases, one incident can be serious enough to amount to sexual harassment. Now, normally when we're talking to our clients about harassment, we typically mention that harassment tends to be a course of conduct or a pattern of conduct, and we do state that it's very rare that one incident of sexual harassment can be serious enough to amount to that potential liability. But unfortunately, as it relates to these company holiday parties, when alcohol gets involved, typically the conduct in these sorts of situations gets escalated beyond to the point where it's possible at these parties that any incident that occurs could be one of these one-and-done situations. And the definition that I just reviewed does apply in mostly all jurisdictions across Canada. And so the types of behaviors that we're talking about here obviously include suggestive remarks, compromising invitation, unwanted physical conduct. Again, people sometimes get a little loose if they're a little bit inebriated, and that's why these issues arise. So what can we do to potentially limit our liability as it relates to sexual harassment? Well, as I'd mentioned at the beginning, provide training to managers and employees on sexual harassment in the workplace. Review that respect in the workplace policy. If you have an E2R drafted policy, our policy is great as it relates to explaining the definition of sexual harassment and especially going over that formal complaint mechanism. Remember that it's not a one-and-done situation from a company perspective. Don't terminate on the spot. Follow that complaint procedure outlined in the Respect in the Workplace policy should something happen. So we want to make sure that we're following up on any complaints, following that process, crossing all the T's, dotting all the I's. Another way just to generally prevent it is to consider inviting significant others. Generally, people can be better behaved if they know that their spouse is watching them. So that's one way to potentially reduce liability, as well as avoiding mistletoe or other tradition or games where personal contact may come into play, as well as...
So Twister is a no-no. Joe's old enough to remember Twister.
Hey, Twister's still around.
It's still around? Okay.
Still around. It's probably updated, though. and have a business professional casual dress code in effect. So So we're limiting the outfits that can be worn on either side, not applying blame, just trying to reduce the situations that can occur, preventing those comments, preventing the unwanted physical contact.
So perhaps when you think about holiday parties, one of the issues that probably you haven't given any particular thought to is how the workers' compensation scheme applies. So the question in any injury when it comes to workers' compensation is simply this: did it arise in the course of employment? Well, if it did, then in all likelihood, the employee who has incurred the injury can make application for benefits to the applicable workers' compensation board. So let's think about it. We're serving alcohol to our employees. This is a employer function, and then you may recall Aaron speaking to whether it's mandatory or not. Of course, that's going to be an interesting consideration. If I make it mandatory as the employer, well, then it's part of your work duties. So I'm serving you alcohol. The alcohol spills from Joe on the floor, and then Sally takes a spill because of the wet floor and injures her hip. Well, is that arising during the course of employment? Well, we made it mandatory, you had to attend. Why isn't it? In all likelihood, it is. And depending on the severity of that injury, of course, from a claims experience standpoint, you may be faced with a very costly claim. And that, as you can see, even in our point number two, can apply to dancing. Literally, it can be. Once again, we're sliding into the consideration of whether it's mandatory or not. And that's why Aaron made the point about if you make it non-mandatory, well, then you're volunteering to, it's like you're going to your buddy's party, right? But questions of fact will come involved in that. It's one thing to say it's not mandatory, wink, wink, better see you there, but it's voluntary, right? That could play into whether it's compensable, right? So you got to think about this, right, in terms of, once again, your liability that you face or are vulnerable to when you're throwing a holiday party. So, in terms of limiting your liability, right, you want to have insurance coverage. So if we look at the positive side of workers' comp, I just described the negative side. Well, the positive side is at the end of the day, right, employees that are injured in the course of their employment make application for benefits, you have no liability other than your premiums, of course, that being impacted by your cost experience. In the absence of workers' comp, well, then you potentially are going to be sued for negligence. So you need to have insurance, right? So if it's voluntary and employees are attending, and then perhaps therefore not an accident arising out of the course of employment, well, then you might get sued. If you were negligent in the way you conducted the party and that gave rise to the injury. So make sure you've got insurance. See what's incorporated in your policy, right? Obviously, you're trying to anticipate what might happen. Make sure you're taking the precautionary measures so that Sally doesn't slip when Joe spills his martini, which, by the way, just by way of anecdote, I will be the first to admit that a martini is hard to keep in the glass the whole time. It often spills out. Even when it's your first drink, any kind of movement, it spills out. Not to suggest that it's not based on personal experience at all, just what I've observed. And make sure managers, right, they understand their supervisory duties, even at the holiday party. Make sure there are people responsible there to watch over and see what's going on.
So enough with the Debbie Downer stuff. Let's move on to the good stuff, the time off from work that we get as a result of these wonderful holidays at the end of the year. Well, this year, Christmas and New Year's are falling on a Sunday, and that's typically a non-working day for many employees. So what do we do as it relates to the statutory holidays this year? Well, I would love to say that there is one rule that applies across the board in all provinces across Canada, but we don't live in a Canada like that. We live in a Canada that has a bunch of provinces that all has different employment standards legislation. And as a result, each province differs in terms of its rules as it relates to statutory holidays. So we've provided for you out on that screen all of the different provinces. Major ones to take note of are particularly the fact that in Alberta, an employee is not entitled to statutory holiday pay and not entitled to an alternative day off. They're the ones that unfortunately do not get to benefit from the fact that the statutory holiday is on a Sunday this year. In addition, British Columbia and Quebec, the employer doesn't need to provide an alternative day off. However, the employer is still required to pay that statutory holiday pay instead. For all the other provinces, typically, it's just that the day gets moved to another working day. So Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, Newfoundland, they move it to the next working day. So that would be the Monday for them, as they don't have Boxing Day. In Ontario, because of Boxing Day, while the rule is that it can be moved within 3 months of the statutory holiday, in fact, most employers this year are providing it on December 27th because Boxing Day, the 26th, is the holiday. And then New Brunswick, you just must provide another day off with pay as designated by the employer. Again, most employers are choosing that Monday. Now, as it relates to actually paying out for the statutory holiday, we strongly encourage you to confirm with the provinces that you're operating in what the minimum employment standards legislation requires as it relates to the calculation of statutory holiday pay and any eligibility requirements. Obviously, feel free to contact E2R with any questions that you may have and speak to an advisor. And just from a general HR perspective, we want to make sure that we're communicating with employees well in advance of what we're choosing as that alternative day off so that employees can properly plan. And we want to make sure that we review the year-end payroll schedule just to ensure that if there are any conflicts as it relates to dates for processing payroll as a result of these holidays. So just some items to add to that checklist of yours.
So Erin was just talking about statutory holidays. Let's go on to vacation, another wonderful topic. Now, typically, in most cases, obviously not all, the vacation year will coincide with the calendar year. And virtually in every jurisdiction, it's the employer's responsibility to ensure that employees are taking the minimum vacation entitlement each year. For those of you with Ontario operations, you may remember some years ago, there was the mandatory requirement that employees take vacation time. That's since been amended to permit employees with, I believe it's Director of Employment Standards approval and the employee agreement, to actually completely deny themselves any vacation time. Of course, you would owe vacation pay, nevertheless, as an employer, but at least in Ontario, it's possible for the employee to say, hey, I'm not going to take my allotted vacation time. Well, of course, that sometimes gives rise to a whole bunch of issues in and of itself. We're going to touch on in seconds about use it or lose it policies. If you're permitting employees to not take vacation time and then carry it over, sometimes there's questions as to what is that contractual term. And by the way, if you don't have a good use it or lose it policy and you're continuing to permit an employee to carry over vacation, I mean, we have clients that have outstanding accrued liabilities on their books for vacation that is beyond remarkable. I mean, you're looking at employees with 60 and 70 days of vacation, right? So that is a significant liability. And then often what happens is the employer, particularly around December when you're starting to do this vacation audit, or at least you haven't done it, now you're doing it, you realize, oh my, we've got to deal with this vacation issue. We got to make sure they take their vacation because we don't want to carry this on our books on a continuous basis. So, if you do the audit now, you'll see those outstanding vacation entitlements, and you'll determine a strategy as to how you're going to now reduce that accrued liability. Right? Typically, you're going to say, if possible, encourage employees to use their outstanding vacation before the end of the year. Right? In terms of scheduling, just as a general reminder, you know, you have, as the employer, the authority to schedule vacation. Although there was a recent Ontario case that we don't have time to get into, which challenged that to the extent that the employer elected to change an employee's pre-approved vacation. So it's not without its asterisks attached, but as a general statement, the employer can schedule vacation. But as you'll note in the slide in front of you, certain jurisdictions require that employees be provided with a minimum amount of notice when the vacation is scheduled by the employer. So by way of example, in Alberta, if you're going to schedule it as the employer for the employee, you're required to give 2 weeks advance notice. In addition to vacation time, of course, employees are entitled to vacation pay in accordance with provincial minimum employment standards legislation. Why is that particularly noteworthy? Well, it's noteworthy because of the second point on that slide. Employees who earn commissions, non-discretionary bonuses, or overtime are entitled to vacation pay on these amounts. Now, there are some variations from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but do not forget this point. Vacation time is separate from vacation pay. Vacation pay must be calculated in accordance with the Employment Standards Act. Typically, however, if you provide a greater benefit, so even if you don't do it properly, but you otherwise provide a greater benefit than the employment standard provides, then that greater benefit, that term that you provide will prevail and you're okay. But it becomes a question as to whether how that math works out. Because if you're not incorporating commissions, bonuses, or non-discretionary bonuses, and overtime into your calculation of vacation pay, you may not be complying with minimum standards. All right, so you want, as part of that vacation audit, you're going to want to do a reconciliation of vacation pay against total annual earnings, right? Because that's what you're typically, that's what we're talking about, you're calculating vacation pay on. So you want to make sure you're hitting the right number. Now, if there's a balance owing, typically, then you're going to want to pay that out at the end of the year. And with respect to carryover, you want to make sure you're doing that accurately. It's amazing. And look, you know, it's funny. We always laugh on our end because vacation seems to be a relatively straightforward, or one would think, a straightforward issue, but it's remarkable how confusing and complex particular vacation questions are. So, at least as it relates to, you know, at your end, when you're carrying over, make sure you've got the numbers right in terms of what's being carried over. And if you have a use it or lose it policy, that's absolutely fine. And it's probably advisable and recommended that you do it. But you have to make sure you're still complying with minimum standards. We sometimes see clients that have a use it or lose it, and they fail to recognize that they still have to ensure they maintain the minimum standard requirement.
Now, just before we move on to performance review, we actually do have a question from a client with regards to vacation, and they're wondering if, I believe it means, is mandatory vacation time required for all types of employees, including casual and part-time employees?
Well, I think the question's a good one, because by way of example, salespeople in most jurisdictions, we don't want to say all, but in most jurisdictions are not entitled to vacation. Now, you have to meet certain requirements in order to fall into that category of a salesperson, but just by way of example, yes, salespeople, and the underlying philosophy of that is they're off doing their thing whenever they do it, and so there's no control, so vacation's not an appropriate attribute of that that bundle of duties. So, absolutely. But as it relates to part-timers, and I believe casual was mentioned, casual, unless, you know, we're not aware, unless Aaron can correct me right now, if there's some pocket somewhere, Northwest Territories or otherwise, that really any kind of employment falls within under the employment standards legislation, and they're not exempt from vacation time and vacation pay. So that category of employee is not like a salesperson. If you're just calling them a part-time or casual, they will be entitled to vacation time and vacation pay, obviously on a pro rata basis, given they're part-time.
And what I think a lot of our clients do is, for example, if you were just hiring somebody on a fixed-term contract, well, because underneath employment standards legislation, you're not required to provide vacation time in that first year of employment, instead just accrues, they're entitled still to that vacation pay. So, for example, in Ontario, that 4% vacation pay, you can either pay that out on each paycheck or at the end of the fixed-term contract. Obviously, you need to get employee authorization to pay it out in such a manner, but then you can clearly state in the contract that they're not entitled to take vacation time during that first year. Now, for anybody who has a contract that goes longer than 1 year, that's when, even as a part-timer, quote-unquote casual employee, they would still be entitled to that vacation time. So performance reviews. Now, obviously, performance and salary reviews can be conducted at any time of the year. So obviously, whatever your current practice is, that's totally all right. It just happens to be that a lot of our clients choose the end of each calendar year to undergo this process. We have the year now under our belt. We feel pretty confident with what the employee was able to achieve. So it does generally make good sense to conduct the reviews at this time to get everything in place for next year in the event, for example, you provide salary increases or bonuses. So make sure that we review all new goals, expectations, so that we start the new year off right. And in the event that we do provide any bonuses, typically what's a nice gesture is to pay it out at the end of the year, right around the holiday season, so that people can pay off their gifts. Alternatively, also making ensuring that any salary increases are communicated and reflected in the first payroll. Again, though, if that's not your practice, quite all right. Again, it's just that many of our clients do conduct performance reviews around this time.
For you folks in Ontario, although AODA, right, the Accessibilities of Ontarians with Disabilities Act, is pushing out in different directions in Canada, so we're seeing, of course, similar legislation elsewhere, but just in terms of the timing, effective January 1, 2017, employers with 1 to 49 employees, so it looks like we got everybody now, are going to be responsible for compliance in the following four areas. As you see, hiring means you'd have to notify employees and the public that the employer will accommodate the needs of people with disabilities in the hiring process. You can post that information on your website, include the information in the job posting. Workplace information, you have to ensure that workplace information is available in an accessible format if the employee asks for it. And that could include information the employee needs to perform the job, as well as general information available to all employees. Under the heading of talent and performance management, if you have performance management or career development processes, you have to consider the needs of people with disabilities when holding, right, formal or informal performance reviews and promoting or moving employees to new jobs. And then you also have to communicate accessibility policies. You have to indicate to employees about the employer's policies with respect to supporting people with disabilities, and telling new employees when they're hired, and tell all employees, of course, if those policies change.
And just by way of note, if that slide might have shaken you in your boots a little bit because you weren't aware of this, or you recently got an email from the ministry in charge of compliance with regards to this, we do have a very handy employment standards toolkit that assists in these four areas that if you have not received from us, please feel free to reach out, let us know, we'll send you that toolkit. That toolkit will go in more depth into these four areas to help you be compliant with this employment standard. Okay, so we made it through the holiday season, we're alive and well, and we get to January 2017. And we're back to chatting about the statutory holidays, because what is a year without starting off with talking about what days we get off this year? Well, again, what we just want to bring to your attention is to review any statutory holidays that may fall again on non-working days. A review of the 2017 calendar year indicates that it's January 1, which we've already discussed, and July 1st is also on a Saturday this year. So make note of those holidays. Designate a substitute holiday if you're operating in a province that requires that. And sometimes what's just a handy tip and a tool that you can give to employees is just publishing a calendar designating the statutory holidays that the company will observe. And obviously advise any employees of company-wide shutdown or blackout periods for vacation if you do have them, so employees can just plan their vacation schedules accordingly.
Yes, this may be mundane, but important to include in your planning for 2017. Contact and status information is up to date, right? I mean, it's sometimes remarkable that when we're trying to get in touch with employees, we have, you know, information that's not up to date and current. So you want to make sure we have that current information, and certainly that applies to emergency contact information. It routinely, employers have old, archaic information regarding the emergency contacts. And boy, when it's an emergency situation, it feels very uncomfortable not to have that contact information. So you want to make sure that's up to date. And reminder to file all new TD1s, right, federally and provincially. And the Quebec, of course, 1015-3-V, if the personal situation has changed. You've got to file those with Revenue Canada.
This is a reminder as well. Each jurisdiction sets provincial minimum wage rate. We encourage you to diarize any upcoming dates for minimum rates changes in the jurisdictions that you operate in. By way of note, most provinces, including Ontario, Alberta, and Saskatchewan, have designated October 1st as the date minimum wages will increase. But just by way of note, BC is September 15th, and New Brunswick is also going to be going to an annual rate increase. They have not yet announced their date for the rate increase, but it'll be coming out shortly. And just by way of note, New Brunswick is in fact going to index their minimum wage rate as well to the consumer price index, which is similar to what Ontario and Saskatchewan have moved to. So given that New Brunswick is moving what appears to be closer to what Ontario and Saskatchewan do in terms of the minimum wage, it's possible that they may set as well the October 1st date, and that Nova Scotia sets an April 1st date as well. Other provinces, though, do not set annual wage rate increases, and they have not indicated a wage rate increase for 2017 as of yet, but obviously we will keep you posted if we get any further information. And obviously, just make sure that you just review any exemptions to minimum wage legislation in a number of provinces. So, for example, you know, type of occupation, a big one is if you're operating a restaurant business, there's typically a lower minimum wage rate for servers as a result of tips, and as well, any wage rates for employees.
Make sure you prepare and file the T4s. By the way, as lawyers, when we get involved in litigation, the T4s are often very helpful, right? Because when you speak to a client and you say, well, what was Sally earning? Well, Sally was about 40,000, and sometimes she got a commission. Set. Do you have the T4? Maybe we'll just take a look at the T4. And if that T4 is very, very helpful, of course, because we get exact information regarding earnings. But of course, you also have an Income Tax Act requirement to make sure that's filed. The T4 slips have to be filed by February 28, 2017. And of course, if you're using a third-party payroll provider, you want to confirm the timeline to get into that third-party provider to make sure they process it in a timely manner. You can provide the T4s in electronic format, but if you do that, consent must be received in writing to the employer to communicate that information via electronic delivery to the employee or former employee.
In addition, another item on your checklist relates to statutory deductions, because each year various government bodies set the contribution rate for various statutory deductions in order for employers to calculate the amount to deduct for employees. So we're talking about CPP, EI, and if you operate in Quebec, the Quebec Pension Plan and Quebec Parental Insurance Plan. Now, we have been checking. Canada Revenue Agency has been noting that changes are in fact coming to 2017, but the changes have not yet been published. I even checked today and it still has not been posted. But just so you know, the Canada Revenue Agency has an electronic service that can notify clients immediately of any changes for payroll deductions. The website is indicated up there, so you may just want to sign up for that so that you can be advised as soon as they become released. And then, unfortunately, we have been, probably since October, we've all made our CPP and EI contributions, so our paycheck, we saw a nice little increase at that time. Well, we lose it as of January 1. And so we may have now just spent our entire paychecks on the holidays and the gifts, and now we get even less money on our paycheck. What a joy. January is such a fun month. So it might just be helpful to just send a nice reminder memo to all employees before their first pay, reminding them that they may in fact see a decrease in their total net pay as a result of now having to once again for CPP and EI.
Isn't that, Aaron, I find that amazing that more often than you would think, we hear from employers that are getting, you know, grumblings from their staff about the reduction in net pay. And because there was a failure to communicate and just, you know, employees understandably don't understand the process of how you reach the maximums and then bang, away you go again in the new year to have those deductions. And so you get, and what's amazing is you get, sometimes you don't get an employee communicating the grievance and they're just unhappy for a period of time until the realization hits them or they get some information from a friend or something. But in the meantime, they've been unproductive for a period of time because they're disgruntled because their net pay has changed and they don't ask the question. So it's really a good idea to make sure people understand how it works, and it's not your fault. It's simply your compliance obligation. So for payroll considerations, as we move into 2017, you know, you want to determine if there's any conflicts in processing payrolls, right, or paydays. You want to make sure where the payday falls and whether it falls on a statutory holiday so you can communicate pay dates and payroll cutoff dates to everyone, right? This is just a matter of being very clear and transparent so everybody understands and nobody misunderstands, right? And you want to communicate any changes to payroll deductions, right? So, for example, the group benefits, if that's changing, then you need to communicate that. Once again, it's about being proactive, communicating, so there are no surprises for employees.
Going beyond payroll, now to just posting and training requirements, we just want to make sure that we're fully compliant as it relates to any posting and training requirements. So again, just commonly all jurisdictions have posting requirements in connection with employment standards, health and safety, and or workers' compensation. Those typically include actually posting the company's health and safety policy and potentially respecting the workplace policy that is required in Ontario, in addition to any ministry-provided posters such as the employment standards poster in Ontario. I cannot tell you how many clients forget that in Ontario there is an employment standards poster that must be posted. It is provided by the Ministry of Labour. It does need to be posted in that workplace in order to be compliant. And so just so you know, we do have some handy-dandy tools for you on your member portal at e2rsolutions.com. We do have employment standards charts that do in fact outline all of the posting requirements. So log on to your member portal, take a look at the jurisdictions that you operate in, and just confirm that you have everything posted there. As well, always nice to go over what training you might need to potentially plan for in the new year, because again, some legislation does have annual training requirements. So we just want to review those to make sure we're compliant, maybe start scheduling them, particularly potentially planning for respect in the workplace training, any WMIS training, first aid training, et cetera, and any obviously organization-specific training requirements. And then again, just going back to vacation, if you do in fact have people who are getting increased vacation as a result of increasing their years of service, we want to make sure that we are implementing those vacation entitlements accurately. So whether or not the change occurs as of January 1 or potentially on the anniversary date, we want to make sure that our system is set up correctly so that the employee automatically gets their entitlements when they're entitled to, and then you won't get that complaint.
Policy and employee handbook review time. This really is something you should think about, because it's a great time in the new year to look at all the internal policies and your handbooks and to determine if an update refresher is required. And, by way of note, as lawyers, if you're litigating and an employee is taking the position that he or she was not really aware of the policy that's incorporated in the handbook, and there you have the sign-offs, as it were, electronic or otherwise, for that employee on an annual basis, and that employee has had indeed the opportunity to review the employee handbook and has had specific training perhaps in relation to certain, if not all, the provisions of the handbook. That's a wonderful position to be in when the employee is trying to duck and weave and somehow take the position that he or she wasn't aware of it. So it is a very good idea to do certainly periodic sign-offs, we'll call it, of the employee handbook, in addition to, of course, reviewing it and making any appropriate changes. And we also have to note from a legislative standpoint, the legislation often incorporates a requirement that employees annually review certain policies. So by way of example, we've included on the slide, in Ontario, under the Occupational Health and Safety Act, you must prepare and review at least annually a written occupational health and safety policy as well as the company's harassment policy. So you'd like to have a minute of a meeting or something that demonstrates you took a look at it, even if no changes are made, right? So you want to make sure then that your organization, once again, is compliant.
The New Year is also a great time, in addition to your employee policies, to review your employment agreements. And we strongly encourage this for employers, especially in light of recent case law developments in 2016. Absolutely imperative, particularly around Ontario, and if you're an employer who offers any sort of bonus to employees, we want to see your employment agreements. We want to revise the language in there because there were certain cases that came out this year that weren't necessarily favorable to employers as it relates to the bonus. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get into that today, but if you do want to review employment agreements, let us know and we can obviously chat about the case law at that time. Also, good to always diarize and keep track of anybody who's on a fixed-term contract, whose contract might be potentially expiring. Again, we're always concerned with fixed-term contract employees, of them working past the expiry date, which would make them an indefinite-term employee. So make sure to diarize that. Follow up with us if you need a further extension agreement for that employee. And if you are, in fact, considering offering promotions, do not forget that often it's a good time to review that employee's employment agreement, potentially get them to sign off on it. If you are conducting your promotion and you're providing a salary increase that's outside of the normal scope of what that employee normally receives, again, a great time to put them on a new employment agreement. And if you generally require any sort of checks or background information from your employees on an annual basis, whether that relates to their driver's license or background checks for certain types of employees, certainly a good time to put the process in place to get that information, just to check that off your list as well.
So by way of conclusion, to the extent your to-do list is already the length of your arm, we apologize for adding to that list or lengthening your arm. But these are important tasks to close out the year and begin the new year. So, to the extent you need assistance from us in sort of assisting you through the meandering paths of compliance, by all means, as always, we're here to assist you, and we can assist with any internal communications you require, etc. So, with that said, we want to wish you a fabulous holiday season and a happy new year, health and prosperity for all, and we look forward to seeing you in January 2017, where the calendar will change, but once again, our ages do not. Thank you.